From Vermont Public, this is Brave Little State. I'm Sabine Pooks. We've been putting together an annual road name show for 7 years now. 7 years! And we've noticed some patterns. For example, the first stop on any road names investigation should be Esther Monroe Swift's famed and very rare book, Vermont Place Names, Footprints of History. That book is kind of our road names Bible. Second, town clerks know a lot of local lore. And if they don't know the answer, they'll probably know someone else who does. Lastly, a road with the word agony or hate or devil in it, it's likely because that road is really, really steep. You're going to want to remember that rule for later. But even with several years worth of road names investigations under our seatbelts...
Isn't that interesting? I can't even figure out how you would think that from this.
There are still plenty of surprises. Welcome to Brave Little State, Vermont Public's listener-powered journalism show. Every episode starts with a question that's been asked and voted on by you, our audience. Today, our 7th annual Brief History of Vermont Road Names, where we go to the ends of the earth, or of the state, to find the why behind Vermont's most eccentric road names. For this episode, you picked 2 roads and 1 lake that you wanted us to investigate.
How did Hell's Peak Road in Londonderry get its name?
There is a road sign that says Pumpkin Harbor Road. And I've looked at that and I've often marveled at what a strange name.
And I wonder, when and why did it become Lake Willoughby instead of Willoughby Lake?
Yes, these are stories about Vermont place names. But they're also stories about memory and memory making. How and why we remember the things we do.
The stories have a kernel of truth to them, but the truth is somewhere in between.
We're a proud member of the NPR network. Welcome. Road name or place name questions, they usually go something like this. Hi, my name is so-and-so, and I want to know why this road is called this. Investigation ensues. And this investigation started off like any other. Producer Adia Gostin and I were assigned a question about Lake Willoughby in Westmore in the Northeast Kingdom. Question asker Beverly Decker wrote in, I've lived all 75 years of my life at Willoughby Lake. When and why did it become Lake Willoughby?
So, we started down the usual pathways, calling people with businesses around the lake to see what they knew.
Yeah, I don't know.
I thought you might know since your business name sort of plays on Willoughby.
Yeah, well, I don't.
No one we called had a concrete answer, but we pieced together a few different stories from some Vermont history books, and the gist is this.
There was a guy, or 2 guys, or a woman, whose first name or last name was Willoughby. And either this Willoughby held the first title to lakeshore property, or they fell through the ice when they were transporting lumber across the lake, or they were just really well-loved around town.
Yeah, we couldn't really hone in on one theory. So we visited the question asker, Beverly, at her home in Westmore to see if she had any other leads.
And turns out...
So how did you take it?
I thought you wanted to know what the name Willoughby is from.
Isn't that interesting? I can't even figure out how you would think that from this.
We were asking the wrong questions.
Because it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Syntax and everything.
Beverly doesn't care about the Willoughby part of the phrase, but about the order of the words lake and Willoughby. You'll hear it if you listen closely to her question again. When and why Willoughby Lake became Lake Willoughby. It's a question about syntax.
Which never even occurred to us, because why does it matter whether some people say one or the other?
Well, it matters to Beverly.
To me and my family members and most of the locals here, there aren't many of us left, it's Willoughby Lake. And then I see it now transitioning back to Lake Willoughby.
When Beverly calls herself a local, she really means it. Beverly's family is the Perkins family, and the road she lives on, it's called Perkins Lane. It's just up a hill from the lake.
My parents owned cottages, and we had lakefront. And during spring, summer, fall, my siblings and I lived at the lake. We would go out right after breakfast, be dragged up at lunchtime, and go back down, and then be dragged up at 5 o'clock. So we literally lived in the water. Yeah.
Beverly says the lake has become a lot more crowded, and she doesn't like going down there anymore. And she thinks how people refer to the lake, it could be tied to whether they're a tourist or a local.
And in talking with my sister, she said, oh, I used to get so cranky when people from out of state would call it Lake Willoughby. She'd say, it's Willoughby Lake.
Beverly's already started looking for clues about the lake's name. She pulls out a photo album full of painted postcards of Willoughby in muted blue-green hues.
So you could look through these and see.
Wow.
From postcard to postcard, year to year, we see both names.
1941.
Uh-huh.
Yep, 1941, and it's Willoughby Lake. Let's
see. Even more puzzling, Beverly pulls out a business card for a lakeside retreat. On the front side of the card, it says Lake Willoughby, and on the back,
Willoughby Lake, Lake Willoughby. Yeah, so
on
funny.
The same card.
All this variation, it doesn't mean people don't have their favorites. A historian we reached out to early in our reporting posted a thread in a Northeast Kingdom Facebook group asking for information about, quote, the name Lake Willoughby.
And oof, the blowback was intense. Commenters were up in arms about the order of the words, with one even writing, blasphemy.
Adia's never seen the lake, so we head down to the South Shore to take a look.
How would you describe this lake?
So much grander than I thought it was going to be.
Willoughby's crystal clear waters are sandwiched between two massive mountains, Mount Pisgah and Mount Hoare, giving the impression of a fjord. The mountains are wooded most of the way up with some stretches of exposed rock near the top. Some boats bob in the shallow cove. This used to be the more secluded end of the lake. The state has since expanded parking access here, and there's more development these days. But to these two outsiders, it all looks pretty similar to how it did in Beverly's antique postcards.
I don't know, it's really beautiful.
On our way out, we stop some tourists who are putting on sunscreen in the parking lot.
Can we ask you guys if you call it Lake Willoughby or Willoughby Lake?
We call it Lake Willoughby.
You call it Lake Willoughby?
Yeah, it's my first time.
In, we catch a pack of motorcyclists at the Willoughby Lake store.
We're from New York, so we say lake first.
Yeah. Is that a thing?
Yeah. Lake Erie,
Lake Champlain,
yeah.
Lake George.
Though we didn't start off caring or even noticing which word came first in the lake's name, we started seeing it everywhere and found even the state-made signs couldn't make up their mind.
This one says Willoughby Lake. Willoughby Lake Shoreland Restoration. But this is Lake Willoughby. Wow.
Okay.
Lake Willoughby, you know, almost gives that country club feeling.
This is Beverly's nephew, Kimball Johnson.
But the Willoughby Lake, the sound and feel of that is like that old slipper that you keep going back to even though you bought the new pair and they sit in your closet. I don't know if I'm making sense that I'm saying it that way.
Kimball says he thinks the name has always ebbed and flowed. But he remembers that sometime in the 1990s, the state of Vermont wanted to standardize names of places for tourists. And they picked Lake Willoughby. By the way, we haven't been able to confirm this with the state, though we do know the lake's official state and federal name is Lake Willoughby, according to a federal database of geographic names. The standardization, it wasn't popular with everyone, and it didn't really stick.
Kimball worked for the local Chamber of Commerce and remembers when he made up some signs for the chamber to welcome people into Westmore.
It said, "Welcome to Westmore, home to Lake Willoughby." And I took some heat from that one. I'm not going to lie.
Kimball says the state went with Lake Willoughby because of the lake's size.
They wanted to give a little bit of a more of a nuance as to, if someone was seeing it on a map, what the size of that lake might be.
The idea that bigger lakes should be called lake then name is not just a Willoughby thing. A few years ago, scientists in Quebec and Virginia wrote a paper. It's called Lake Name or Name Lake, the Etymology of Lake Nomenclature in the United States. Bingo! Like us, the authors were puzzled by the variability in lake names in the U.S., and they found that lakes with larger surface area tend to be called lake, then name. Think Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire, Lake Powell in Arizona, or Lake Tahoe in California. The paper said that's because those lakes appear more impressive and imposing from the shore. And for whatever reason, like Kimball, people see lake, then name as a more fitting order. But that's not a hard and fast rule, because language and settlement patterns play a role too. The vast majority of lakes in England, for example, they have the word lake after the name. And that holds true for most of New England too, which was settled by English colonists. But Vermont has a lot of lakes that go the other way, which could have something to do with the migration of people from Quebec to Vermont. When referring to lakes in French, whether in Quebec or in France, the name follows the word lake, like Lake Champlain. So, the overlapping sediment patterns of French and English settlers with different naming conventions could be why there's not one, but two names for the lake. And all this says nothing of the lake's Abenaki name, which, by the way, we weren't able to track down. What we do know is Mount Pisgah, next to Willoughby, it's also called Mount Anance, after an Abenaki chief who spent time in the area. Beverly wanted to know if those names were used more in one time period or another, and whether that might track with patterns in tourism. But according to Scott Wheeler, there aren't clear trends. Scott's the historian who posted about the name on Facebook. He also writes about kingdom history for his publication, Vermont's Northland Journal.
You know, I have found no consistency in the naming of the lake. From 1850, I found it, and it's both names are used interchangeably and almost equally. Even in our own household, my late wife, who grew up not far from Lake Willoughby, she referred to it as Willoughby Lake, and she used to say to me, "Why do you call it Lake Willoughby and not Willoughby Lake?" I've concluded, I think it's more your relationship with the lake. If you're intimate with it, it seems to be Willoughby Lake. If you're a bit further removed, such as myself, it's Lake Willoughby.
Scott thinks people get used to using one name or the other, and from there, they sort of perpetuate among certain circles. Some people dig their heels in.
We're creatures of habit. My wife didn't break me of the habit of calling it Lake Willoughby in our 40 years of marriage.
And people make sure their way gets passed down, like Kimball Johnson, Beverly's nephew who worked at the Chamber of Commerce.
I've got a 6-year-old granddaughter, and you know, in our household, it still references Willoughby Lake. So there's a 6-year-old that'll grow up with that name in mind. She'll be making the funny face at someone when they call it Lake Willoughby.
Producer Adia Gostin joined me in reporting that story. Okay, so as much as possible, we reporters try not to start an assignment making assumptions. But sometimes we get an inkling, a tip, a hunch, and sometimes that hunch is wrong.
Brave Little State's Burgess Brown has a story behind name number two.
Sarah Hazelton doesn't live in Londonderry. She's a few towns over in Manchester. But her family's from there, and she finds herself passing through often. And when she comes into town on Route 11, there's one road that she clocks every time. Snaking down a hill right into the heart of town is the ominously named Hell's Peak Road.
And it's really actually quite a lovely road to drive along. And so it just seemed so odd to me that such a pretty road, not that Vermont is short of them, was called Hell's Peak. You just have beautiful houses, kind of sweeping fields. You have some farms up there. It's just, it's really quite idyllic. I don't know how anyone could ever confuse it for hell when it feels like heaven.
I can assure you that Sarah does not work for the Londonderry Tourism Office. It's just a really pretty road. So Sarah wants to know, why the disconnect? How did such a heavenly place get such a hellish name?
My only thought, and it just from, you know, driving up and down there is, again, it's quite a steep road. So I thought that maybe it's just because it would be kind of so hard to get up and down there, you know, by foot, by horseback, or even by car.
This sounds plausible to me. We've investigated our share of treacherous road names over the years. Hateful Hill Road, Agony Hill Road. Steep roads get scary names. Sarah's dad grew up in town, and he says there are probably some old-timers around that can corroborate this theory.
So it's possible that, you know, a farmer or two out there knows the answer. Now I'm wondering if I just, you know, kind of asked my father, like, you know, a great uncle up there or something, if they might know the answer before I even submitted this question.
And deny us the fun of a proper radio investigation? I don't think so. I put lines out with the town clerk and the Londonderry Arts and Historical Society. No one knows any Hell's Peak lore, but they say they'll ask around. Over the next few days, texts start rolling in with names of people who might know the history. Names like Don Hazelton, Deb Hazelton, Robert Hazelton. The keen-eared among you will remember our question-asker Sarah's last name, Hazelton. Turns out this might indeed be a family affair. I get in touch with Robert, who goes by Bob and also happens to be Sarah's grandfather. Bob's got the scoop, and he agrees to meet up. He gives me directions. Head about a mile up Hell's Peak Road, take a left, and then drive to the end of Pitchfork Lane. Have I found the right place?
You're up in the woods.
Bob lives in these woods in a little cabin he built himself. But we're meeting up next door at his brother Don's place.
There's cookies on the table.
There's also books and maps and newspaper clippings. From these and from an oral history that's been passed down through the family, Bob's pieced together a pretty clear story of Hell's Peak Road. It's a story that starts with his grandfather.
His name was Walter Merrill Hazelton. He was an interesting individual. He made moonshine. That was his biggest claim to fame. He'd been caught a few times and paid his dues and went along his way.
In 1927, Walter Hazelton bought a farm at the top of this hill that we're meeting on from a guy named Albert Douglas. And there was some debate about what to call the place.
And the story goes from my grandfather that he was down visiting the next-door neighbor, whose name was Walter West. And Mr. West says, "Well, how's everything up on Sunnyview?" He said, "That's what Douglas calls it." He said, "Old Lady Leffenwell called it Hell's Peak because the wind blew 366 days a year." Well, my grandfather had heard enough. He said, "By God, it's going to be Hell's Peak." And that's what it's been.
Hell's Peak was hellish not because of the steepness of the road, but because of the wind. Walter found that moniker the most fitting, and it stuck. Bob says from then on, people in town started calling our road in question the Road to Hell's Peak Farm. And then that slowly morphed into just Hell's Peak Road. The farm partway up the hill joined in on the fun and started going by Halfway to Hell.
And what about Pitchfork Lane? How did Pitchfork Lane get named?
When they were naming roads, Don and Deb's two daughters, they sat at the kitchen table here and said that we've got to come up with a name for our road. The girls piped up and said, let's call it Pitchfork Lane.
Bob pulls out a small yellowed square of paper.
That's a SERP label that my dad made.
It says, made by W.M. Hazelton and Son, Hell's Peak Farm. And there's two sort of grinning devils holding their pitchforks. Now, like Sarah, I've found Hell's Peak Road to be a totally idyllic place. Certainly not hellish. But Bob says that's because the landscape has completely changed since he was a kid.
Could we take a drive?
Sure.
So I can see some of the stuff you've been telling me about?
Sure. Be glad to.
I displace the toolboxes and drills and reciprocating saw that typically occupy Bob's passenger seat, and we set off.
One time I was able to take a sled and get on the sled in front of my house, and I was able to slide all the way to school. To our left here, that used to be a field, pasture, and my dad used to summer young cattle there.
And it's dense now.
Oh gosh, yeah.
When Bob was growing up, these hills were a bare patchwork of pastures and fields, first dotted with sheep and then dairy cows. There were a handful of other farms here, and without all the trees, it was much more exposed and windy up here. The sort of conditions that could inspire such a brutal name. And the original family farm sat across 150 acres at the top of the hill.
When we were in college, Mom and Dad sold some of the land for tuition. And so when we got through, there probably was only 50 acres left.
After college, Bob took up the family business. But like a lot of dairy farmers at the time, he couldn't turn a profit. So he sold the cattle and became a contractor. Today, he still helps his brother keep a small herd, and they still tap trees come spring. They're the only ones farming on the hill now, and some of the only ones living there full time. Many of the properties have become second homes and short-term rentals that do big business thanks to their proximity to ski resorts like Stratton and Magic Mountain and Bromley. Bob helps his brother and sister-in-law take care of 60 properties in the area.
It's been a big change. However, I'm glad to see it. I'm glad to see it because they provide work for my brother and sister-in-law. And those people that have purchased these houses literally pay us to mow their fields, even though we're getting the crops off the field to feed the beef cattle.
And the wind? It's not nearly as bad as it used to be.
We used to slide off the roof of the house onto the porch, onto the snow. I mean, it drifted like crazy. I can remember going out in the morning to take care of the calves, and I thought I was going to be blown away. There's nothing to stop it. Hurricane Hazel, what was that, 1956, 57? I thought I was going to tear the house out.
What did it sound like?
Like a freight train. I mean, just unrelenting wind. And you could feel the house sort of pick up and sit down. A hell of a place, a hell of a place to live. Yeah.
That story was produced by Burgess Brown. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our 7th annual Brief History of Vermont Road Names. I'm Sabine Pooks. There's a thing that happens when you start thinking about strange road names. You start seeing them everywhere. There's one that gets me every time when I'm making the drive north out of Burlington to the mountains.
I'm really glad this one won the voting round. Reporter Samantha Watson took this road name on in the final weeks of her summer internship. Samantha takes it from here.
Oh, wow.
You can't stand up and play these. You have to sit down. So, the reason why it's difficult for me to play them for you is that it takes several minutes for the pipes to settle down and get in tune.
Wow.
This is John Finlay. I'm in his living room in Underhill. He plays the bagpipes, the kind you press to inflate with your arm, called Julian pipes. That's one thing I want you to know about John. The other thing I want you to know about John is that when his road name won the Brave Little State voting round, people he'd never met before started approaching his wife around town.
And said, "Hey, are you John Finley's wife?" And she said, "Yeah, why?" "Well, we've always known about Pumpkin Harbor."
Pumpkin Harbor Road in Cambridge. It's got John perplexed.
I mean, it's a very strange name. I mean, pumpkin, you can kind of understand, you know, pumpkins, it's agricultural and all that stuff. But harbor, where does harbor come from?
Pumpkin Harbor Road runs along the Lamoille River, just off of Wrongway Bridge in Cambridge. John also asked about Wrongway Bridge when he sent in his question. We'll get to that later. But both are about 200 miles inland from the Atlantic Ocean and 20 miles away from Lake Champlain. There's no harbor in sight, no inlet to dock a sailboat, and certainly no shore to build a lighthouse. But since he sent in his question, John's heard another explanation from all those people who've been talking to his wife in town. This one, it actually has to do with the river.
So some people have said, "Well, we've heard that back many years ago, there was a gigantic flood down the Lamoille River. And so this big flood flooded out this pumpkin patch of some farmer, which washed the pumpkins down the river until it got to this bend where there was kind of this eddy, and the pumpkins kind of floated there and kind of gathered there. And so as a joke, the locals called it Pumpkin Harbor."
John isn't sold on this story.
So you're saying you're suspicious that, you know, pumpkins can't really float on their own?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
I wasn't sure if pumpkins floated either. I couldn't find a pumpkin in the summer to test it out for myself, but upon some Google searching, it turns out they do. Pumpkins can float. With that done, I just needed to place this flood, the one that swept up the pumpkins and pooled them in some type of makeshift harbor next to the road. I emailed residents of Pumpkin Harbor Road, consulted local history texts and recent newspaper articles, and through all of them, this story that John heard seemed to check out. And many of the sources cited the Great Flood of 1927 as the weather event in question.
The height of the water came through Waterbury in the night.
This is from an interview with George Kidder for the Vermont Historical Society.
That made it particularly horrifying, I think, for the people that were involved. They talked about a house washing down the street with people screaming out of it because they didn't know what was happening.
The Great Vermont Flood, as it came to be known, took place over the course of 2 days in November of 1927 and claimed 84 lives, While none of those deaths were in Cambridge, the damage there was great. In the Cambridge area, the flood of 1927 seemed to be the largest tragedy in modern memory. When people talk about it, they talk about their grandfathers that lived through it and recall drowned herds of cattle. Some houses still have watermarks where the flood climbed almost a century ago. Pumpkin Harbor Road has overlapping tales that all hold the 1927 flood at their center. It makes sense that a tragedy this significant could be the story behind the road.
The stories have a kernel of truth to them, but the details might be a little wonky. You know, why does this account say this? Why does this account say that? The truth is somewhere in between. And that's where I come in.
That's Jen Bartlow. She's part of the Cambridge Historical Society and has over 40 years of experience as a genealogist and researcher. And she's Any Road Name Reporter's holy grail. Seriously, she's like the Einstein of town lore. I meet her outside of the Varnum Library in Jeffersonville. She brings a stack of printed newspaper clippings and town documents and one black and white photograph. Jen says about a year ago, the Historical Society came to her with this photo, something from their archives they couldn't locate geographically.
And they couldn't figure out where it was because here's this huge, looks like a body of water, almost like a pond.
The photograph was taken in 1890. It captures a rowboat with four monochrome passengers paddling on a pond. Behind them, a dirt road and a farmhouse.
And luckily, there was writing on the back of the picture, so...
Jen says, please remember to write on the back of your photos. It helps historians like her.
I love it. There was a pond left that contained frogs caught for their legs. Like, ooh.
In addition to some colorful details about the alleged pond, there are a few names listed on the back of the photo. Jen did some sleuthing and traced the property in the photo to a place on Pumpkin Harbor Road, about a mile up. Sure enough, there's no pond on the property, just land that dips down into a shallow valley.
I said, that's probably the harbor right there. Everyone was like, oh, wow, it really was a harbor.
Today, the land is overgrown with tall grass and brush. It gets swampy when it rains, although Jen says it hasn't filled up with water like it did in that photo in a long time. But back in the days when it used to be farmed, the land sat like an empty cup on a low table.
So it'll just never look like that again. But it's nice to have that picture to say, yeah, there it is. That's Pumpkin Harbor.
The photo Jen found, it predates the 1927 flood by more than 30 years. Jen says the Great Vermont Flood was likely just one of many that swept over the road since it was first created. According to John Hayward's 1849 Gazetteer, the first settler of Cambridge arrived in 1783. He planted 2 acres of corn, which were, quote, overflown with water in the fall and nearly all destroyed. Even the very beginning of the town's recorded story involves flooding, involves rebuilding. Back then, floods were called freshets and occurred in the area through all seasons of the year, either from rain or melted snow.
I think there were freshets 1798, 1817, and 1828. So, you know, pick a date.
Jen doesn't know exactly when the road was named, but she says the Pumpkin Harbor name predates the Great Flood. According to the newspaper article and reference books, the road was known as the Harbor Area, or Harbor District, as far back as the early 1800s. The first mention Jen found of a pumpkin harbor, it actually came in 1842 in the Lamoille Standard newspaper.
Great pumpkin! We have this year raised a pumpkin in a field of corn, which weighs 40 pounds. And then, you know, they're like, can anyone do better? And then they say, can any of the dwellers in Pumpkin Harbor in Lamoille County? So you
it feels obvious to say, this story has echoes of the present. In the flooding earlier this summer, in 2024, Pumpkin Harbor Road was impassable. Though the so-called harbor didn't pool with water like it used to, it became marshy and soaked. Over the years, over centuries, the road's inhabitants have dealt with house flooding, closed road access, and the feeling of waiting in worry as the water creeps above the Lamoille's lip.
You know, when people talk about 100-year floods, it's, I don't know where they come up with that, because they happen much more often than 100 years.
In 2019, the town raised part of the road in hope of mitigating the frequent road closures. But within the same month of the project's completion, the road flooded over again. And another effort to address flooding led to the creation of Wrong Way Bridge at the road's base in the 1950s. Turns out, the bridge gets its mysterious name from an attempt to reroute the highway behind Cambridge into neighboring Jeffersonville. The state ran out of money before it could finish the project. But the bridge, which now wrongly curves to direct traffic up Pumpkin Harbor towards Fletcher, remains. I kept wondering why the flood of 1927 is so ingrained in everyone's minds as the origin of the Pumpkin Harbor story. And I returned to something Jen had told me about when she does genealogical work.
Telling factual truth that I've found in records and things like that, I soften it. It's like, you know what? Aunt so-and-so had, you know, she had the basic idea, and it's true that these pumpkins, you know, gathered in this area, but it wasn't in the 27 flood, and it wasn't even in 1870. It was here, and then I'll say...
In other words, collective memories can take on lives of their own, and we're often protective of them. 1927 sits in the soft spot of history. It can be accessed by people who are still living through the memories of their grandparents, passed down delicately in kitchen table stories. The flood of 1927 was a tragedy, and what followed was a harsh season of reckoning and rebuilding. With something so big, it feels right to have something to validate it, to name it. It's a way of saying, we lived through that. Now, it's another season of more reckoning and rebuilding. While the pumpkin part of the name may be a memory of a specific event lost to time, the harbor part, the piece that sticks out as odd, to question asker John Finlay, it's a link between the road's past and present. Because it's an old Vermont story, one, as Pumpkin Harbor Road tells it, that's been repeated and repeated. But it's a name whose very persistence tells of the reckoning and rebuilding that's followed for just as long.
Anyway, that's... Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I know that's... A little more time, I would play something, but...
Reporter Samantha Watson. By the way, that 1927 flood that Samantha talked about, it's what inspired then-President Calvin Coolidge to make his famous Brave Little State speech a year later, the speech this show is named for. Thanks so much for listening to the show. And thanks to Beverly Decker, Sarah Hazelton, and John Finlay for sending in such great place names. If you have a road name you want us to probe, or any other question about Vermont, you can let us know at bravelittlestate.org. That's also where you can see pictures from our reporting and find our six other brief histories of Vermont road names. We're on Instagram and Reddit at BraveStateVT. This episode was reported, produced, edited, and mixed by Adia Gostin, Burgess Brown, Samantha Watson, and me, Sabine Pooks. Our managing editor and senior producer is Josh Crane, and our executive producer is Angela Evansy. Ty Gibbons composed our theme music. Other music is by Blue Dot Sessions. There are a lot of people who helped with this episode. Special thanks to Sophie Stevens, Laura Nakasaka, Jack and Dave Delancey, Bud Corser, Deborah Simpson, Elaine Cashin, Luisa Dottoli, Beatrix Beisner, Susie Obomsawin, Catherine Delneo, Niels Reinhardt, Kelly Puyala, Allison Marino, Hillary Batchelor, Deb Hazelton, Andrew Hazelton, Carrie Alley, Peter Upstrup, Bill Morey, Cynthia Williamson, Aurora River, Aaron Calvin, and Andrew Liptak. And as per usual, we did consult Esther Monroe Swift's Vermont Place Names book for this episode. It's an extremely hard book to find, and somehow our colleague Michaela Lafrac has two copies. Thanks, Michaela, for lending us one. Brave Little State is a production of Vermont Public. If you like our show, you can make a gift at bravelittlestate.org/donate, or leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. We have a lot of exciting episodes coming up this fall, and we can't wait to share what we've been working on. Until then, I'm Sabine Pooks. Thanks for listening, and happy driving.